Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Scholar Tea. We are two scholars bringing you the tea. Someone got a little tenure, so we bring a little more tea than we used to.
The tea is spiked.
It's spicy.
Hot toddy.
Have you heard of people saying salt is spicy?
Salt is spicy, no?
It's salty, but people be like, oh, it's spicy. So, speaking of spice, temp check for the day. If you were a 99s or 2000 music video aesthetic, what would your mood be on today?
So I'm with the Y2K. I forgot the director that this was their aesthetic, but Janet Jackson, she used to have this video I used to love. It was like, doesn't really matter, but it was for the Nutty Professor soundtrack. And she's just like moving through her home, but her home is like the Jetson home. I love that video, but I just loved the energy. It was like colorful and vibrant. And that's what I want my weekend to be. The sun is out, you know, sun's out, thighs out, but these thighs gonna be covered. You know, that's the vibe that I'm feeling right now. That's the energy. We're recording on a Friday afternoon, you know, so I'm in a good mood. I also got some money today that I was not expecting to get. I was like,
we got money?
We got monies. Was not expecting to get this little change that came into the account. And I was like, oh, and you know what I did?
It
moved it right on to the savings. Okay. I almost want to get a CD so we can get some compound savings. Okay.
You know what that is? Growth.
Growth. Okay. Growth. These mortgage prices are real high. I'm still on the hunt, but okay.
I feel the same. I am feeling all things fluorescent lighting inside the grater, toaster, Hype Williams. You know, everybody looked like they were inside a grater or a toaster in the 99s, 2000s. But especially when you think about what's it going to be with Janet Jackson, Busta Rhymes, or The Rain with Missy Elliott. Like, just wrap me up in a trash bag and throw a fan on me. I'm in a really good mood. Really doesn't matter. It's really eccentric feeling. I'm willing to wear my dark purple lipstick and some spandex or, you know, a nice flowy coat, something comfortable. Thighs are not going to be out because it's 30 degrees here, but the sun is out. So I'm excited.
Yes. Bust me out the plastic. I'm acting brand new. Is that what the children say?
I don't know. I got to ask Kennedy.
This episode, we are going to do what we usually do. We're going to honor our scholar of the week. We are going to spill some tea, higher education, always something to talk about, y'all. We have a wonderful interview with the godfather of racial battle fatigue, Dr. William A. Smith at the University of Utah. I'm going to highlight what's problematic today. You come in with them jokes, and then we have so many people to celebrate, so many affirmations, people getting recognized and getting the awards. And we're going to leave you with the affirmations of the day.
So this week's Scholar of the Week is Cesare A. Warren. Cesare A. Warren, PhD, is an associate professor of equity and inclusion in education policy in the Peabody College of Education and Human Development at Vanderbilt University. He was a classroom teacher and school administrator before completing the Policy Studies in Urban Education doctoral program at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Prior to joining the LPO faculty, Dr. Warren was a lecturer and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and faculty member in the Michigan State University College of Education. He has held visiting appointments at Stanford University and New York University's Metropolitan Center for Research on Equity and the Transformation of Schools. He is a scholar of race and intersectional justice, with particular interest in understanding the conditions that facilitate Black boys' educational success. More broadly, Dr. Warren employs primarily qualitative research methodologies to critically examine factors that both enable and sustain humanizing experiences of school for Black youth in the United States. Please join us in just uplifting and celebrating Dr. Warren.
Shout out to Dr. Warren, Cesare, the good brother of the A5A.
Nice. So we want to talk about these myths that are being perpetuated around higher education in the media. And we thought it'd be really good today to actually fully discuss an article that was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education. It was written by Scott Carlson, and he's examining the polarizing effects of what it means to earn an advanced degree in higher education right now. Scott Carlson noted that despite its problems, American higher education has demonstrated its usefulness and is still valued by large swaths of the American public. In a Chronicle survey of the public perception of college, nearly 80% of those who graduated said college was worth the cost, while about the same share of all respondents would recommend it to a friend or relative. He noted that sitting beneath the surface of most of these discussions that are talking about whether or not higher education is worth it are the factors driving the negative view of college. Of course, ideology and politics are among them, with Republicans losing the most confidence in higher education. The biases aren't always elucidated in the media, however. In November, Newsweek reported on a survey of 70,000 small business employers that had concluded that most companies say it isn't worth it for their employees, but the story neglected to mention that the companies also had an ideological bent. For instance, one that was surveyed indicated that they were also seeking to connect reliable job seekers with serious companies without all of today's woke nonsense, which is something that the founder described with regard to higher education and students going to college. So Carlson continued, and he says, the other agenda under the surface is a longstanding drive to get a piece of the hundreds of billions of dollars swirling around the higher education space, and that a number of companies are in the business of making money by offering alternatives to college or supplemental academic courses or programs. And so they're benefiting from the narrative that higher education is too slow or too distant, isn't offering students what the cost is with regard to needing to find a good job, and even perpetuating the narrative that higher education should be closely aligned with employment in the first place. So thinking about how we're trying to traverse this terrain of higher education, our roles as educators, administrators, faculty, staff, in what ways do you think we could continue to help uplift the shared responsibility and the shared benefit of higher education?
Well, I think we can do all the things that we think are right in the terms of, you know, marketing ourselves, outlining the benefits. But until we have a real conversation about cost and debt, you know, the narrative of is it worth it is going to prevail, right? And I think it's a real conversation with state legislatures, you know, is higher education for the public good or is it a personal good? And if it's for the public good, then it has to be invested in by the public. And as you know, as we all know, the steady decline of investment in higher education from state legislatures, state budgets, especially for public institutions, causes alternative ways of funding an institution. And alternative ways of funding obviously comes from raising money, but it comes from tuition dollars, and tuition goes up and that passes on to the student. The debt goes up. It becomes this cycle. So then now we're questioning, you know, should I be going in this amount of debt to get this degree to earn this salary, right? And it becomes a real conversation of personal good. But then we're not having a common good conversation of what does it mean to have an educated society. And for me, it's really thinking about some people are going to benefit from a university degree and some people aren't. But that's always been the case within higher education. One of our future interviews talked about, you know, education being the great equalizer. Well, equalizer for who and for what, right? There are people that are highly educated that have mountains of debt, and there are people that getting a TikTok on and making three times what we make, you know, in a month, right? So it's really thinking strategically about who is higher education for? How do we market it for that purpose? But also understand that we're not for everybody. And I think where we got caught up in higher education, those of us that believe in it, is we think that it is for everybody and everyone should have access to it. Yes, I agree with that. But when we say that's the only way to go, then I think we marginalize and we leave people at the margins. You have a student looking at higher education institutions, or I've committed to one, and I don't know if I would be okay if my child came to me and was like, I'm not going to college. Well, where are you going, right? But I think we, in our generation and generations, a couple of generations before us, that's where we've been socialized or conditioned, and we haven't considered the higher education is not for everybody. So what's the alternative?
I think that first, I feel like if higher education wasn't worth it broadly, then so many people wouldn't be working so hard to keep us from accessing it. And I think the other thing that I'd like for us to be more careful around is when we talk about education being the great equalizer, even, there are still avenues that are related to our well-being holistically that we can connect with because of the ways that we move around higher education spaces and therefore are connected with people or concepts or ideas or spaces that maybe isn't necessarily attached to a monetary finding, but is attached to other parts that inform our lives. And I think, you know, the problem in the US and thinking about what higher education means in the lives of people, I kind of limited to earlier, it's the fact that we have connected getting an advanced degree to a job or money. And we think about success in monetary terms because we are a capitalistic society. But I think it goes beyond that. I think it goes into some of the things that we study, right? Like personal growth and development, enhanced understanding of concepts, practicing empathy even, and becoming a more empathetic person and understanding the lived experiences of others. I think some of those things do then show up in your material life or livelihood by way of, you know, being able to seek career advancement or being able to write that bomb ass grant to get that program off the ground in your community. But I also think there is this more holistic understanding of what it means to engage, what it means to be a human. And I do think that some really interesting things happen in the incubator of higher education that I would like to see more people have access to. And I think for me, I personally struggle with some of these commentaries in the media around higher education and its worth because of the fact that we still boil it down to dollars. And I know it's not cheap and I know it's become an industry. Like, I'm not naive to those things, but I think we're missing like the human component of what it could be to ensuring that our society has access to an advanced education. I think some of those things get lost in that conversation because we boil it down to dollars and cents. And again, I think then therefore the efforts being made to keep people away from it, I think there's an understanding of the danger of having an educated populace.
And the Republicans have been initiating this strategy for a while now, and it's all for political gain, right? If you don't have a highly educated society, they don't question, right? They constantly vote against their own self-interest, or they cling on to a narrative without critically critiquing or examining the policy and how it has implications.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what it's going to take for it to get better, because I think we are almost 3 or 4 steps behind in terms of the strategy implementation of piece by piece tearing down higher education. Everything from funding to the value of the degree to labeling woke, right? Like, the narrative has been snatched from us to a point where even people with college degrees are questioning, you know, was it worth it? So then they've now passed that on to their children. Like, to me, I almost feel like we're behind fighting against the narrative or reimagining what higher education can be and for whom.
And I prefer to take a more hopeful stance in the sense of understanding that some of this is cyclical and that we're not necessarily in a place that we haven't been in before. It just is manifesting in what feels like a different way, with the hope that, you know, this upcoming generation, they find a new way of imagining what an advanced education could look like. And maybe it isn't going through the ranks of college per se, but is transforming what it means to have a post-secondary education in a way that does positively impact the ways that we provide this offering within college spaces.
Yeah, that's what's going on in these streets of higher education.
What's up next?
So up next is our wonderful conversation with the Dr. William A. Smith. He's informed my research and my research agenda to be able to be in space and community with him. I'm excited for us, Shauna, but I'm also excited for our listeners to learn from the brilliant mind. Dr. William A. Smith is the Chief Executive Administrator in the Huntsman Mental Health Institute in the School of Medicine and the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. In this position, one of Dr. Smith's responsibilities is to lead the Huntsman Mental Health Institute in its effort around justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion at the institutional level and in national projects. He is also a full professor and former department chair of Education, Culture, and Society at the University of Utah. Additionally, he holds a joint appointment in the Ethnic Studies Program, Afro-American Studies Division, as a full professor. Dr. Smith has served as the Associate Dean of Diversity, Access, and Equity in the College of Education and a Special Assistant to the President at the NCAA Faculty Athletics Representative at the University of Utah. Dr. Smith is the co-editor of the book, The Racial Crisis in American Higher Education, The Continuing Challenges for the 21st Century, and the third edition for Racial Crisis in American Higher Education was just released in 2023 with all new chapters. He has provided over 100 keynote lectures, presentations, and interviews from South Africa to Australia to Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. And among his most influential presentations have been the Utah Supreme Court, the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, and some of the United States leading colleges of medicine, University of Utah Medical, University of California, Riverside, and Cornell, to name a few. And additionally, he's one of University of Utah's most highly cited scholars, top 10%, according to Google Scholar. We are excited to welcome Dr. William A. Smith to the Scholar T Streets. So excited right now because we get the opportunity, the privilege to engage with Dr. William A. Smith. And many of us consider you, you know, the godfather when thinking about affirming and naming the experiences that we're having, especially when we feel like we're going crazy, especially in these white spaces. But Dr. Smith, you've had a long career. Would you mind giving us kind of a career trajectory of kind of where, how you got to where you are in terms of being a senior faculty member at University of Utah?
Sure. I did my doctoral training at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. During that time, I had a kind of a startup family. So my wife, she was doing her doctoral training at the University of Illinois in Chicago. So we were kind of a distance away from each other and had my, at that time, I think one son. And, you know, our goal was to be together, obviously, at a university once she graduated. By the time I had gone over to Western Illinois University as a professor, so I stayed in the state just to get us some benefits, you know, while she finished graduate school. And I would commute to Chicago pretty much every week for a couple of years. Then I got a postdoc at the University of Illinois Chicago. I was able to be there till she graduated. And then we looked around and said, wherever there's a job that we both can take in the country, either in neighboring universities or the same one, we would give it a shot. Who would know that we would come all the way out to, you know, University of Utah, one of the whitest states in the country. And many of my former students just couldn't believe that that was going to happen. That they used to call me brother professor at Western Illinois University. Like, brother professor, you going to Utah? And I said, yes, brother, there's black people there too. So we came out here and been good for us. My wife's an associate professor, doing a lot of great things, major grants, working with people on violence prevention, elimination of drug abuse, and early sexual debut among adolescent teenagers, women. So her work is stellar. She's working with the National Academy of Sciences right now. So I'm really proud of what she's doing in her career. And for me, I'm just continuing the effort to try to help explain and understand racial battle fatigue and all its manifestations, how it enters our life in ways that we think we can recognize and other ways that go unnoticed.
Absolutely. And your research is so important in the aspect of understanding not only the environment, but the psychosocial stressors that racism has on us, and us as in people of color, us as in Black people. Can you talk to us about your current projects and how you hope they might continue to positively influence policy and practice in terms of higher education?
Yesterday, we just got a paper accepted, which we had been waiting to hear from, and it's on Black and white principals in a Midwestern state and looking at racial battle fatigue among them. We just submitted another paper on that same data. In that project, what I'm trying to articulate is a better way of learning that we have primary stressors and secondary stressors. So primary stressors are things like shock, anger, fear. So if someone were to come up to Dr. Shauna and just, you know, yell at her, her first reaction would be, you know, you've entered my boundary. I'm getting upset, and to defend herself. So that's a healthy defense system. It's time limited. The stimuli is right there. And once she removes that stimuli from her, she can go back to normal. But for many of us who are particularly Black, but also other marginalized groups, we often go into what's called the secondary stresses. And the secondary stresses have two categories. One category is stressful event sequences. And those are things like frustration, disappointment, irritability, and defensiveness. What it's saying is that the stimuli is still there. I say stimuli, it could be a stimulus, but for most often it's a stimuli. And so that stimuli are still there. And so it's still targeting us and making us have to respond constantly to the point that now we're getting frustrated. And we know that any formerly acute stimulus that causes us to respond, that turns into a chronic stimulus, has consequences of poor health outcomes. And the second category of that is distant stressors. These distant stressors are once the stimuli is no longer there, but we're still responding as if it's there. So we're still feeling things like apathy. We're anxious. We have resentment, worry, disbelief, hopelessness, and helplessness. And so in this study on Black and White principles, we see that the principalship is very stressed. So we see high stress among all of them. But where we notice the most significant difference in stress outcomes is that first category of chronic stress. And that happens to be the one that the stimuli are still there. You're still dealing with it. It's frustrating you, your disappointment. Think about going to work every day, and that's how you feel. And most of it is race-related, right? So that's one of the main projects that we're working on is looking at principles. And the other, we're looking at really expanded literature review on Asian Americans and racial battle fatigue. So oftentimes, they're still called this quote-unquote model minority. So they don't suffer. They don't have stress. They don't have depression. You know, they're model. They're perfect. But we know that's a lie. We know it's untrue. And so what we want to do is to show in what unique ways Asian Americans are dealing with racial battle fatigue. And so we've looked at over 3,200 studies. We've broken those down into component areas, thematic areas, all help to explain what racial battle fatigue as a systemic racism-related repetitive stress injury.
Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be looking for those publications once they are inked, because I think about folks that are trying to make sense of not just the immediate stimuli, but, you know, what you're talking about with regard to the tertiary experiences once it's kind of gone, but not really, and trying to make sense of that in their lived experience in the academy. I think that's important when we think about our longevity as educators. So we thank you for your work. And thinking about your very expanse and impressive career, and given where you are in your career, what excites you about your work and continued possibilities?
You know, I think what excites me the most is that it's entered the mainstream. People, just everyday people, are talking about it. People who may never have gone to college to pick up article or hear a professor talk about racial battle fatigue. You hear it among those people. And when you hear it in the mainstream, you know that it has a life of its own, that it's really doing something intentional, and they're talking about it. I've seen it on YouTube, conversations and other places. So it is something that people say, this explanation explains what I'm going through. I'm not crazy, right? I'm not alone. It's other people who are feeling like this. So that gives you an affirmation. And anytime you affirm somebody's reality, stress starts to go down automatically with just that being able to come together on that issue. And so I appreciate it for that reason. And at this point, I think our research librarians have told us over 2,000 dissertations have used racial battle fatigue in whole or in part. So that's reassuring. So we know it's in the up and coming researchers. We know it's in the classroom, and we know it's in the mainstream. So that gives me appreciation. But now at this point, we have to use it as a offensive plan. We have to move off of the defense to the offense. And if we know these things are true and they're happening to us, we have to do studies now to bring down racial battle fatigue by taking control of the spaces and places where racially marginalized people exist.
I feel like I'm sitting and learning, and you're teaching us today. So thank you for that. How have you remained true to yourself and not let the academy steal your joy, Dr. Smith? And maybe it has stolen your joy, but you didn't stay there or stay in that space. And how do you remain relentless when thinking about the work that you want to do, the work of affirmation, the work of affirming? I'm getting a lot of emails now and even tweets saying that, you know, I'm a racist because I want to do DEI work and what's happening in the state of Florida. So how do you let those those things of the academy of the times that we're in not steal your joy?
Well, from the very beginning, I looked at the academy and what I was doing in it as my night job. My day job has always been to work for our people. I just happen to be from that little older generation, you know, that tail end of the baby boomers. And so growing up in Chicago and Black Power was prevalent, and hearing these speeches and Stokely Carmichael, now Kwame Ture, coming to talk and other big name individuals, that was very impressionable to me. And the wisdom that they offered in these lectures. And my mother was a Chicago public school teacher. So she would make sure, and very pro-Black. So she would make sure that I was at these meetings when I was a real young boy, you know, these talks. And so I always knew that this wasn't the house that we built. Right. And so if it's not the house that we built, we might not be welcomed into it as other people are welcomed into it, which means we have to build our own home. And so most of the things that I do at work, quote unquote, is something that's going to help our people during the day. So this really finances my work to work for our people. And if once you keep it that way, then you understand what your purpose is. And then the other thing is, even though I'm in predominantly white Utah, if you come into my house, you know, this is a Black house, right? And so we have to control our environment. And that's one of the most important things for healthy outcomes, is that you have to reflect what you want to be and what you want to see and what you need to feel. And so you see African art, African-American art, my wife's sorority, you know, Delta Sigma Theta's all over that side. You might see my fraternity all on the other side, but other rooms, you're going to see Blackness and Africanness.
Well, you mentioned building a house when houses aren't welcoming our bodies, and maybe even controlling environments around us so that we feel validated and healthy. What additional words of wisdom and encouragement would you offer those being targeted by opponents of DEI work, or just opponents of people of color in general and their existence?
I think what we have to realize is this: we're a critical people in this army. And it is that we are at war when anything attacks us. Malcolm X said one time that we don't have to receive a letter first class and be invited into a war. you know when you're at war. Sometimes we act as if we need that invitation. And so we have to remember that while we're dealing with the situation, there are core values that drive our work: justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. These are not abstract concepts. They're fundamental principles. These are things that can guide our pursuit around how we think about equality and equitable outcomes and an understanding society. And we really have to understand that to those feeling targeted or disheartened, I just urge them to be resilient. We have generations of racial socialization that teaches us how to be resilient. And then understand that we're not alone. You know, we're working in together to build this inclusive environment that is based on valuable principles that are human principles. And these are inhumane acts that are trying to take this away from us, right? So we have to oppose, but oppose together. Have a strategy, but be strategic with other people, which means that we have to tap into our networks. We can't be alone in this. We have to be smarter.
I feel like you're talking directly to me with that advice, because I need the reminder. What we want to do with Scholar T this season, and we've been doing, is thinking about community. And a part of community is knowing who's in your community. So it's play off the game, you know, two truths and a lie. What we would like is three truths, maybe something, you know, people don't know about you, or something our listeners can gain better insight of who you are. And then a dream that you have that you haven't either come to fruition or haven't had time to fully explore. It could be personal, professional, or deep down childhood dream that hasn't come true yet.
So two truths and a lie, and then...
No, just three truths, no lie, and then a dream. So three truths and a dream.
Well, one of those truths would have been my mother was a Chicago public school teacher, which I'm very proud of, because she created a library in our home that She didn't force me to read books. They were just there and they were just tempting me. And so we had, back in those days, what was called the Black Encyclopedia, A through Z. I would always go through them. So that is a very important truth. Another part of the truth is another part of my DNA. My father, William Smith, was a bodyguard for Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King made him chief of security for Operation Breadbasket, which became Operation Push, as we know, what under Reverend Jesse Jackson. So that's a truth that I'm proud of. Third truth is very close to me, and that is that I've been married for over 30 years, the same woman. And had a traditional African wedding ceremony. My wife is from New York City. I'm from Chicago, but we know we wanted to go to the motherland and have an authentic, a true Nubian wedding ceremony, although condensed. And so that was very special to me. So those three are the truths. And the one thing that I still want to do, I have my at least two books on the racial crisis in American higher education out, but I'm still delayed in getting that one major book out on racial battle fatigue that's all encompassing that people can have. And I know I'm way behind on that, and I need to get that accomplished.
Well, I believe you will, for sure. Dr. Smith, it's been a treasure spending time with you today, and we really do appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to share with us. And I'm sure our listeners are really treasuring the space today that we shared with you. So thank you for your time, and thank you for your wisdom, and thank you for all of the contributions you made to the field so that we don't feel like we're by ourselves.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I always enjoy sharing space with Dr. Smith. And one thing that I really want folks to have heard, if nothing else, is the ways that he draws from all avenues of his life to inform his work, and recognizing that you can't separate your spirit, your mind from your body. And so I think that it's because of his ability to tap into all aspects of his life that his research is so rich. And I hope that people are able to take that as a model and inform their practice as researchers and scholars and practitioners in the same way.
All right, Shauna, do we have a random question of the week?
We do. We both have pets, different kinds of pets, but we do. This week's random question of the week: what do you think your pets are up to when you leave them home alone?
So I think this has shifted as the pet has gotten older. So Zora is 4 years old now. You remember when I first got her? She was 4 years old now. And some people still put their dog in a kennel. Some people lock them in a room. It's that bitch's house when I leave. it's only that bitch's house because I trust her, because I really do think she just sleeps all day. Like, she does nothing all day. I almost got a little doggy cam. I still might get one, but she literally is in the same spot I left her. And I could be gone for hours. Like today, I've been gone for hours, and I'll get back and she'll be right there on that couch, and she'll hop off like, time to go out. Before, she used to, like, if I left like a napkin or a tissue somewhere, she would chew that up. She doesn't destroy her toys anymore. She's never like chewed my shoes. She doesn't get into the trash. I think she thinks she's like, I'm going to entertain myself, and I'm going to entertain myself through this nap. So I don't really think she does anything. I also take her to daycare either once or twice a week. So when she is home alone, I do think she's like exhausted, which is nice as well. But I really did luck out in the pet department, because she doesn't entertain herself in a way that destroys my life or my belongings. So I don't, I think she just chills all day.
Look at you being a responsible pet parent, right? We got two cats because the poorly mistaken judgment was that they would not tear anything up if they had each other's company, and they're from the same litter. They torn up a lot of things, and we've had them, 8 years now, which is crazy to me. But these days, I think they're just filing people's taxes and running a drug cartel out of my backyard when I'm not around, like, because they're too calm and quiet. Like, you can't convince me that all you're doing all day is taking a nap, because they're too smart and they're savvy. And sometimes I wonder if they like took the lid off the flower container and put their paws in it just to spite me, because they're evil sometimes, but they're actually really like animalistic in the sense of thinking one thinks that she's a dog and the other one thinks that she's a baby. And the one that people have become familiar with on the screen is Petunia. She's the one that actually thinks that she's a child. So it's really interesting. I have no idea what they're up to when I'm away, but I see how they act when I'm there. And, you know, if I ever have the FBI knocking on my door, I know to turn to them cats.
Those cats hissed at me before. I don't fuck with your cats, child.
Really?
Yes. In Massachusetts, and I was in that living room. Mm. I was like, oh, okay. Your house, not mine. My bad.
Yeah, funny acting. But then the moment you like even flinch in their direction, they would have been like, oh, wait, but just let me. They're interesting people. They're interesting people, those two. Yeah, they're queen pins right now. I'm certain of it because they're too calm. Talk to me about what's problematic.
What is problematic for me this week, Shauna, is your cousins, okay? Your cousins always want the hookup, okay? That is like, oh, you got tickets to the game in terms of like college, football, basketball, or there's a lecture coming and, you know, you got to get on a list or something. And they're like, oh, can you get me? And I'm just like, I work in higher education. I am not rich with celebrity friends and profiles, but they're always looking for a hookup. And I'm just like, what is going on in the sense of, do you think you bruh man from the fifth floor and you can just climb through the window and just always in the end? And there's somebody we both know that's like, I think that's how he navigates his life, is on the hookup. Like, everything is looking for a hookup. I've called this person out on this, and I don't think they know that I'm calling them out. Like, I just think that's the way they move about life. They call it networking. Is that what it's called?
No, yeah. That's not what that's called. No. You know. There's some people that just don't understand that they're just perpetual takers. Mm. Mm.
That's what's problematic this week. Freeloaders. Shauna, ready for them jokes of the week? Give it to me.
I'm going to do my best. I feel like I'm under an innate amount of pressure to be funny or to cackle at my own jokes. And we'll see how this goes. So why don't ants ever get sick?
I don't know. Those immune systems are strong.
Yeah, it's because they have little antibodies.
Clever.
Why can't a nose be 12 inches long?
Pinocchio? I don't know.
Well, if a nose was 12 inches long, it'd be a foot.
Okay.
Can't be over here gentrifying people's locales on the body. You either a nose or a foot. Sorry. Don't unfriend me, y'all. I have an ICU joke, but I refuse to admit it.
Got it.
Mm.
Admit mm-hmm. to the ICU. Got it.
Mm-hmm. I have a microbiology joke, which is surprisingly cultured. Why didn't Juvenile get upset when his MacBook crashed?
Because he had to back that thing up.
Yeah, he backed that thing up.
I just watched Abbott Elementary. So the premiere episode song, Back That Ass Up, is a central theme of the episode.
Can I tell you my favorite tiny desk of all time?
It was lit. I clean my house sometimes to that. I put it on the YouTube on the screen and clean my house to it.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. And I swear to God, if we could ever find a way to be in the same place with that man. Let's move on to affirmations.
Well, first affirmation of the day, Shauna, is to Tia, who is our editor and producer and future Dr. Adelson, but currently Tia, the doctoral candidate, passed her preliminary exam and is at the candidate status. So we are so proud of you, Tia. Thank you for all you do for Scholar T, and we're so excited for you to get to the finish line and on the other side of this doctoral journey.
Also, Dr. Krista Porter, who is the newly named interim dean.
Love Dean Porter.
Right? Dean Porter at Kent State University. Congratulations.
Shout out to the UGA Black women.
Look at that.
Congratulations to Dr. Sherry Watt on being named this year's ACPA Contribution to Knowledge Award recipient. And also a special shout out to our 2024 class of ACPA Emerging Scholars, including Reggie Blockett, Elise Kane, Candace Hall, Moira Ozias, Stefan Santa Ramirez, and Britt Williams.
Love it. This class is lit. Also wrote a couple of recommendation letters. So shout out to my peoples for becoming and entering into the wonderful club of ACPA Emerging Scholars. So today we leave you with this. Embrace what makes you unique, even if it makes others uncomfortable. I didn't have to become perfect because I've learned throughout my journey that perfection is the enemy of greatness. Janelle Monae. All right, y'all, quit playing these games with perfection and go out there and go be great.
Let me see you do that yoga.
Down in Coco Cabana.
You better let them legs out this weekend.
Sun's out, thighs out, just not these thighs. All right, that's been another episode of Scholar Tea. We'll see you in these conference streets.